but to adjuncts everywhere, she's become an emblem, both of their plight and of their fight for labor rights.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Hello, everyone. This is Natural Lee. Thanks for tuning in to Eco Radio. On today's show, we have John Kerman, who will be updating us on all things pipeline. Before we get to that, we'll speak to Jenny O'Brien for the latest update on Lawrence on Board. But first, the news. Climate and Energy Project, a nonprofit organization in Hutchinson, Kansas, reports that a procedural trick was used, the gut and go, last Thursday, where they took the contents from Senate Bill 433 and placed it on an unrelated House bill, now the Senate sub for HB 2014, so they can bypass the House committee should they get by the Senate. Was the Los Angeles earthquake caused by fracking techniques? The answer is not clear, but what's known is that the quake's epicenter was just 8 miles from a disposal well where oil and gas wastewater is being injected underground at high pressure. In other states, injection wells located 7.5 miles from a fault have been shown to induce seismic activity, points out Andrew Grinberg, the oil and gas project manager for Clean Water Action. Quote, "We are not saying that this quake is a result of an injection," he adds, "but with so many faults all over California, we need a better understanding of how, when, and where induced seismicity can occur with relation to injection," end quote. Shaky Ground, a new report from Clean Water Action, Earthworks, and the Center for Biological Diversity, argues that the close proximity of such wells to active faults could increase the state's risk of earthquakes. According to the report, more than half of the state's permitted oil wastewater injection wells are located less than 10 miles from an active fault, and 87 of them, or about 6%, are located within a mile of an active fault. As Michael Behar detailed in depth last year in Mother Jones, fracking is now a leading suspect for a spate of serious earthquakes in places that hardly ever see them. France stands up to Monsanto, bans seed giants' GMO corn. On Saturday, France's agricultural ministry temporarily banned the sale, use, and cultivation of Monsanto's MON810 genetically engineered corn, the only variety that had been authorized in the European Union. France's reinstatement of its previous ban of Monsanto's controversial genetically engineered crop is another encouraging sign that the biotech industry's iron grip on foreign governments is slipping and that the resistance to these flawed products is continuing to take hold, said Dave Murphy, founder and executive director of Food Democracy Now. The decision was strategically timed to block the seasonal planting of Monsanto's corn by French farmers before a draft law is debated on April 10th, which is aimed at banning the cultivation of foods made with genetically modified organisms. Now we have Jenny O'Brien with the latest update on Lawrence on Board.
Yeah, thank you very much, Natural E. Mike Murphy here, and yes, we do have Jenny O'Brien on the line with Lawrence on Board. Are you there, Jenny?
I am. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Oh, well, thanks for joining us this evening. So, first of all, you've been on this program before, but quickly remind our listeners what Lawrence on Board is.
Yeah, if you remember from our interview last summer, Lawrence on Board is an innovative ride-sharing project. We're working to build a sustainable transportation network using the empty seats in our car. And it looks a little bit like, well, like hitchhiking, but we're putting in elements that will make it safe and easy and reliable and fun to do. You want to hear a little bit about our progress so far?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, since we spoke last summer, we've had a total of 121 research rides, test rides, with me and 22 other volunteers. We've gone to over 40 locations in and around the Lawrence area. And the amazing thing is that our average wait time is still under 7 minutes. It's pretty remarkable. And we were so excited about our results that we wrote a research paper with Ann Dunning from the KU Department Department of Urban Planning and took it to the Transportation Research Board in Washington, D.C., and presented it there to them, and it was very well received, had a lot of excited people. And now we're getting ready to kick off the 2014 research season. We're going to do a whole lot more test rides in a lot of different spots and back up our findings. And then most exciting, we're getting in the starting blocks to launch a pilot, hopefully in the fall of this year. We've kicked off a Rocket Hub crowdfunding campaign, and that's going pretty well, so that'll help to raise money to start everything off. But our most exciting news, this is a really big thing, Lawrence on Board was just nominated a semifinalist for the TEDx Fulbright Social Innovation Challenge. And we still have an interview process to go, and we have a little online voting to do, but the four finalists get to go to Washington, D.C. and pitch their project on the TED stage. So we're pretty excited about that.
Wow, that's incredible. So so did you apply for that, or you were approached?
Yeah, I applied for it. Someone recommended that they thought it would be a great project, and it looks like the TEDx Fulbright people have agreed.
Yeah, that sounds really good. So if any of our listeners are inclined to support that, what would they do?
Well, they could go to www.lawrenceonboard.org, and there's more information about how you can help get this project off the ground.
Okay. I got a couple of other questions before I let you go, Jenny.
Right.
First of all, I guess I neglected to mention at the outset that you were featured in the most recent issue of Greenability magazine. Congratulations on that as well.
Thanks. Yeah.
So the word's getting out there, huh?
Yeah, word's getting out. A lot of people are finding out what we're doing, not just in the Lawrence area, but all across the country. I've got people in Massachusetts and California and Ithaca, New York, who are all looking at this project and maybe wanting to do a follow-along pilot once we get up and running.
Okay. I ran into someone over the weekend and was talking to him about this, and he raised a concern that this may compete, you know, or how do I phrase this? This may take away from funding for mass transit. And what I expressed to him is my impression of Lawrence on Board is it's generally people in outlying areas riding to and from Lawrence. Is that for the most part it's where there is no transportation, public transportation. Is that right?
That's exactly right, Mike. It's mostly designed for people, well, like me, who live out in rural areas to get into their jobs and grocery stores and doctor's offices, or at least to a place where they can catch a bus to where they need to go. So it's sort of a feeder into a transit system, and it shouldn't really take away from the ridership. In fact, it might even improve the ridership, because if you don't have a complete picture, people aren't going to give up their cars. They need to be able to get everywhere they need to go without their car. And to have an option like this kind of fills in the gaps.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then whenever we talk, Jenny, I'm always picturing people in rural areas holding up a sign saying, you know, need to get to the Merck or whatever. Until today, I never really thought about the return trip. So has that been part of your testing? Like, are people standing on Massachusetts Street with signs or?
Yeah, absolutely. Getting home is, you know, it's half the problem. So we are testing out, you know, return trips as well as trips into town. It's a little trickier getting back home. Sometimes you have to take a couple of hops. But the key is finding good locations, find a place where the traffic is going more or less the same way that you want to go. And that's one thing I really want to focus on in the 2014 research season, is identifying those stops and making sure that we can get people where they need to go both ways.
Okay, well, that makes sense. And then I guess another question that occurred to me today is, are there concerns? Well, you guys, I guess, vet membership. In other words, if someone has a Lawrence on Board sign, they've been somewhat vetted, or at least to some extent, went through some application process to get that sign from you.
Yeah, that is something that we've been really concerned about. pretty much anyone who wants to sign up as a rider and get the Lawrence on Board equipment and the photo ID, name tag and all that, they'll need to go through a background check so that we can certify that those people really are safe to pick up. The drivers will maybe not be such a stringent vetting process, but they'll be asked, you know, questions about do they have a valid driver's license, of course, and, you know, have they ever had any DUIs or, you know, other points off of their driving record, that sort of thing. And we plan to, you know, check into those things as well.
Are there concerns about, I guess you'll be vetting the riders, so this might not be a concern on that end, but what are the ramifications of maybe having someone, you know, you can get a license at 16, right? Is that someone responsible enough to trust to one of your riders?
Yeah, that's a good question. We're going to set an age requirement of 21 years old for drivers. So they have to be, you know, have been driving for at least a little while before they can sign up to do this. We don't want, you know, to throw our riders in with complete novice drivers and, you know, have some issues that way. But just to put this little fact out there, actually a driver with a passenger in the car is 23% less likely to be involved in an accident than a driver driving alone. So having a rider does boost the safety level for everybody.
Wow, that surprises me, actually. Oh, interesting. You've really done your research on this, haven't you?
Oh, you better believe it, Mike.
Well, before we let you go, once again, give out your website. So if in case people are interested in voting for you for this TEDx Fulbright, what did you call it, award?
Social Innovation Challenge.
Challenge, okay, yeah.
Right, so, and they could check that out on lawrenceonboard.org.
All right. Well, thanks for checking in with us, and I hope you keep us updated.
Great. Thanks for having me on the show, Mike.
Sure. Glad to do it. All right. Jenny O'Brien with Lawrence on Board. Some interesting stuff going on out there, and it does sound pretty innovative, and she's really doing her homework. So we're switching gears now. We're going to go. We've got John Kerman in the studio, who's no stranger to listeners of Eco Radio KC, and John is going to update us on all things pipeline this afternoon, this evening. And so, John, first of all, welcome back to Eco Radio KC.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the invitation to be here and update all our listeners on a subject that we have covered repeatedly on Eco Radio KC because it's been a big issue and an ongoing issue.
Yeah, it certainly has. So a couple weeks ago, There was the closing of the public comment period from the State Department.
Yeah.
And that's particularly about the Keystone XL pipeline.
Right.
The reason the State Department is involved is because this is an international issue. It's crossing our border.
Mm-hmm.
And has there anything happened since that period closed? Has the State Department...
Yeah, so just a little background on the Keystone XL pipeline. This fight has been in the process for a good 5 years now since TransCanada, the corporation that wants to build Keystone XL, first announced their plans to build this pipeline. And it's gone on and on because the climate movement has put up a huge fight to stop this thing because of the way it would enable increased production from the tar sands, which is the dirtiest form of oil on the planet in many ways, but most particularly to us in the greenhouse gas emissions that come from it. So as you said, the most recent developments in the process have been the release of the final supplemental environmental impact statement on the northern leg of Keystone XL, which runs from Alberta, Canada, to Steel City, Nebraska, if it's built. That closed on January 31st, and a 30-day public comment period was kicked off when a notice was published in the Federal Register on February 5th, I believe it was. That ended on March 6th, if I remember right. So that was the last opportunity for the public to have input. But the publication of the final supplemental environmental impact statement also kicked off a 90-day period in which other federal agencies, I think eight other federal agencies, have the opportunity to comment on the report as well. That would, of course, include the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Defense, Department of Energy. I'm not sure what the other ones are, but probably Department of Transportation, since they regulate pipelines as well. Now, it's unclear exactly when that ends. If it began right when the final Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement was released, it will end right around May 1st. And at that point, when that 90-day federal agency comment period ends, the State Department can issue its final decision at any point after that. They can do it right away because it's their decision as to whether or not building this pipeline is in the, quote, national interest. That's what the State Department must rule. But they only actually have jurisdiction, and this is something I only found out recently. Technically, the State Department only has jurisdiction over the part that's right at the border and just the initial 3 miles of the pipeline. So theoretically, a pipeline company could build the entire rest of the pipeline without the State Department having any say in the matter. But, of course, if TransCanada did that, it would be meaningless because they got to have that middle section for it to be a meaningful pipeline. So because the State Department does have jurisdiction over the border crossing, that allowed us to go through this whole process of forcing the State Department to do a better job, at least, of considering the ecological impacts of building Keystone XL. But they still didn't do a very good job because the essential conclusion of that final Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement, even though it did better than the draft in acknowledging that there were higher greenhouse gas emissions from oil produced from the tar sands, they still concluded the same thing as in the draft, which is that essentially, just as much of this stuff is going to get to market, whether Keystone XL is built or not. If it doesn't get to market through Keystone XL, it'll get to market through other pipelines and rail and whatever other means. Therefore, we don't need to really consider the climate impacts because it's going to get burned one way or the other. Now, we in the climate movement don't agree with that. And the reason we don't is that production from the tar sands right now is about 1.9 million barrels per day. But the industry, the oil industry, wants to get that to 6 million by 2030. Now, in order to do that, they need new pipelines going every which direction to the coast because Canada and the U.S. can't use all that. So they have to get it to the world market, which means they need to get it to the west coast of Canada. They need it to get it to the east coast of Canada. They need it to get to the Gulf Coast of the United States, at which point it can be refined and then sold on the world market. And there are proposals to go all those different ways, and maybe we'll get a chance to discuss some of the other ones. The Keystone XL would get it to the Gulf Coast of the United States in Texas. So it's really not true. While there are all these other proposals, Keystone XL is still essential to this plan to increase production to 6 million barrels per day by 2030. So there's a variety of things still in the works to impress upon John Kerry as Secretary of State and the State Department, as well as President Obama, that they must reject this thing because it's not in the national interest, it's not in the global interest, it's not in the interest of life if this thing is built. So we have coming up a big rally in Washington, D.C., scheduled for April 27th. So that's right before this 90 days runs out on the federal agency comment period. That's going to be, it's really interesting. It's the lead on that one is being taken by an organization called the Cowboy Indian Alliance. Now, you don't think of cowboys and Indians having any kind of alliance, but out there in the path of this tar sands pipeline, Keystone XL, they have made an alliance over the fact that none of them, the cowboys or the Indians involved in the alliance, want this thing going through the land where they live and where they make their living. So they have managed to join together and agree on this thing. They're actually going to start their event on April 22nd. They're going to ride
Earth Day.
Earth Day. They're going to ride into D.C. on horseback, apparently, set up a camp near the White House. I'm not sure exactly where. And they're going to camp there until April 27th when they're inviting everyone else to come and support them in a big rally. So 350.org is a big supporter of this. The Sierra Club, National Wildlife Federation, other organizations are involved to a lesser degree, but it's being led by this Cowboy Indian Alliance. So that's the big national Washington, D.C. focus thing that's coming up. But then there's also this initiative that's been underway for a while of the No KXL Pledge of Resistance. So that is basically you go online to nokxl.org if you believe, feel strongly about this, and you sign a pledge that says you will engage in, I remember the language, it's dignified, nonviolent civil disobedience if the State Department rules that Keystone XL is in the national interest. Now, last I read, some 77,000 people had signed this pledge. Whether they'll all follow through or not remains to be determined. But my understanding is that there are 100 actions currently in the works around the country. Now, if this thing comes off, to my memory, it would be unprecedented. I don't know of any other endeavor that has been engaged in like this around an issue with such distributed actions, all timed to take place within a two-week period across the country. Maybe there have been. Maybe I'm just clueless. I don't know. But I haven't ever heard of anything quite like this. There will be a Kansas City action. I'm the action lead for that. If, again, the State Department rules that Keystone XL is in the national interest. We hope that just our commitment, our promise to engage in peaceful civil disobedience if they rule it's in the national interest, and our carefully reasoned factual arguments as to why it's not in the national interest will be enough to convince them to rule that it is not. But if they do, there will be these actions across the country within the 2 weeks after they make their determination. And the two-week period is important because after the State Department makes its national interest determination, the other federal agencies that have the ability to comment on the State Department have 15 days to object to what the State Department rules. And if any of them do object, then it's up to President Obama at the end of 15 days to make the final decision. Well, since there are disagreeing agencies.
Have we heard any rumblings from any of these agencies? Has the EPA said anything?
In the past, under the previous EPA administrator, Lisa Jackson, they objected to elements of the draft supplemental environmental impact statement. This was back last year, nearly a year ago now. But the administrator has changed since then. It's now Gina McCarthy. There were some rumors that Lisa Jackson resigned in part because she didn't want to be the head of the EPA when this thing was approved. Those are rumors. I don't know whether it's true or not. Gina McCarthy has made some public statements that maybe indicate that she doesn't feel as strongly that building Keystone XL would be a bad idea as Lisa Jackson did, but she hasn't made a public commitment. Nothing has been publicly stated by the EPA so far in response to the release of the final supplemental impact statement. We're about a little more than halfway through that 90-day federal agency comment period, and I wouldn't expect them to issue anything until fairly close to the end of the 90 days because this is a big report. I think it's 2,000 pages or something. So they're going to comb through this thing, and the EPA is not going to issue any hasty response to it. So I would expect it to come near the end of the 90-day period. We hope that the EPA is going to strongly object to, because they did object to conclusions in the draft.
Well, that remains to be seen. I do want to back up to, again, when you were talking about the things with the pipeline, the status of the actual build-out of the pipeline. Like, what's going on the Canadian side of the border? Is the pipeline built out to miles from the border?
I have not heard of anything being constructed in Canada. I think that that TransCanada has been worried enough about whether or not they'd get the decision they want from the State Department that they haven't started construction on the northern leg at all. Now, a little more background. Originally, they made a single proposal to the State Department that included the entire Keystone XL pipeline running from Hardisty in Alberta, Canada, to a couple of locations on the Texas Gulf Coast. It's too much detail to go into, but the Republicans in Congress forced President Obama to make a hasty decision one way or the other on it, so He rejected that original proposal, but invited TransCanada to split their proposal into two proposals, one for the southern leg, which is entirely within the U.S., and one for the northern leg from Hardisty to Steel City, Nebraska, which TransCanada did. And they've already completed construction on that southern leg. Now, the southern leg has value for TransCanada whether the northern leg ever gets built or not, because there's been a glut of tar sands product in Cushing, Oklahoma, which the southern leg now enables them to get to the Gulf Coast, to those refineries, and then it can be sold on the world market. So the southern leg has value whether the northern leg is built or not, but it's they still really, really want that northern leg.
Back to the Canadian side, so in terms of resistance, what's going on there? We heard a lot about Idle No More a little while back.
Most of the focus on resistance in Canada that I have read about from, say, First Nations people, which is the name they use for what we would call American Indian tribes in the U.S., has been focused on a different pipeline called Northern Gateway, which is one that a different company, Enbridge, would like to build from Alberta, Canada, to the western coast of British Columbia. But I haven't really heard that much. I know there has been some opposition, but it seems like most of the talk has been about that. The thing is that, if anything, the government of Stephen Harper, Prime Minister of Canada, is even more in favor of new pipelines, new infrastructure, a so-called all-of-the-above energy policy than the Obama administration. It's a pretty right-wing government. So, of course, there's a wrinkle in it that First Nations peoples in Canada have more sovereignty over their lands than American Indian tribes do in the U.S. At least that's the way it seems to me. So it seems like there will be a real challenge. American Indian tribes in the U.S. have said this thing's not going through our land. We will block it one way or the other if it's approved. I hope it doesn't come to that. Things could get really ugly at some point.
I want to let listeners know about a program tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. on Law and Disorder. They're going to be dealing with, apparently, the FBI met with TransCanada industry partners on the Keystone XL pipeline. And a recent FOIA request, which is Freedom of Information Act request, obtained by the Earth Island Journal. According to this FOIA request, the FBI held a day-long strategy meeting with TransCanada Corporation, this company that's building the Keystone XL pipeline. This strategy meeting apparently took place in April of 2012. So do tune in tomorrow morning after Democracy Now at 9 a.m. for Law and Disorder to get the full deal on that.
Yeah, I'll be interested to hear more about that too, because this is the first news today that I have gotten about what was revealed by that Freedom of Information Act request.
Yeah, that should be interesting. So we've talked a little bit about, you know, the First Nations resistance, and perhaps they have more sovereignty on their side of the border than the indigenous folks do on this side of the border. But apparently some folks that do have sovereignty on this side of the border are Nebraska ranchers. Didn't they do something?
Yeah, that was just a court ruling within the last few weeks. I forget when exactly it came down, but a judge in Nebraska ruled that the means by which the government of Nebraska, the state government of Nebraska, approved TransCanada's revised route for Keystone XL was unconstitutional, that it bypassed the legal means for dealing with pipelines. And TransCanada was pushed to change the route of the pipeline because the original route went through a very sensitive part of the sand hills there in Nebraska, and even some people in the government of Nebraska were concerned about that because it's considered to be a treasure there in Nebraska. A lot of folks still argue that it really does still go through the sand hills, and it certainly does still pass over the Ogallala Aquifer, which is another huge concern that people in Nebraska have. But the gist of the court ruling is that there currently is no legally approved route for the Keystone XL pipeline in Nebraska. So until that court case is resolved, TransCanada can't start building this thing, even if the State Department rules it's in the national interest. Now, you know that, in fact, they've announced the state of Nebraska is appealing that ruling, and who knows how long it will take for this court case to play out or what the final decision will be in it. But as of now, yeah, TransCanada has no approved route in Nebraska to build it, and of course, they can't get where they want to go if they can't go through Nebraska.
Yeah, pretty much. And so I think maybe this is a good time for us to take a break, and we've got a lot more to talk about. So do stay tuned to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sim Van der Ein, author of Design for an Empathic World. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how we can reconnect to people, nature, and to ourselves.
New Dimensions airs at 5 a.m. on Tuesdays.
Johnson County Meals on Wheels is looking for some volunteers. If you are interested, please contact them at 913-715-8895. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
All right, and we're back in the studio. And if folks want to join in on this conversation, the number to call is 816-931-5534. That's 816 Westport 1 KKFI. And we'd love to pull you into the conversation about all things pipeline. And so what about Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas? Mm-hmm. Are there people raising objections?
Yeah, so, well, real quick before I get into that, I forgot to mention the website for that big Washington, D.C. rally on April 27th is rejectandprotect.org. We're planning to take a bus to it from the, maybe originating in Wichita, but picking up people in Kansas City, or if we have enough people, we may have one to depart from here, too. If anyone's interested in that, you can get in contact with 350KC by sending an email to 350KClead@gmail.com. That's LEAD. Hopefully we can get a nice big group of people from Kansas and Missouri to go. Back to what you were saying. So regarding Keystone XL specifically, the portion of the Keystone XL pipeline that passes through Kansas is already there. It went into service in February of 2011, if I remember right, because there's a whole other pipeline called Keystone 1 that has been in service from middle of 2010. That one runs from Hardisty in Alberta, Canada, but instead of heading towards the Gulf Coast, it heads to refineries in Illinois, in Patoka and Wood River, Illinois, which is not too far from where my hometown is. But that one already exists, and then they built this, what they called the Cushing Extension, that runs from Steel City, Nebraska, diverging from the regular route of the Keystone 1 pipeline to Cushing, Oklahoma, where there's a bunch more refineries. So that way they were able to take some of the stuff that was coming in on the Keystone 1 pipeline to Cushing, Oklahoma. Well, the plan is to use that section from Steel City, Nebraska to Cushing, Oklahoma as a middle segment of the Keystone XL pipeline. So they don't need to build anything new through Kansas, even though stuff that came in on Keystone XL would pass through Kansas.
So is there going to be some kind of, I guess the term would be confluence of this pipeline?
I don't know exactly what it's
I
don't know exactly what it's all going to look like, but both Keystone 1 and Keystone XL would come together in Steel City, Nebraska. And then some of the material goes on to Illinois, and some would head south through Kansas to Cushing, Oklahoma, where it would connect with the existing southern leg. That's already connected. The section through Kansas is already connected to the southern leg of Keystone XL. So that's already in place. So there's no real place to directly protest in Kansas. The Kansas section is a done deal. Now, talking about local issues We, of course, need to talk about the Flanagan South Pipeline, which we've been covering on Eco Radio KC for about a year now.
Mm-hmm.
So Flanagan South is a different company's pipeline. It's a pipeline that the company called Enbridge is currently building, and they seem to be most of the way done. The most recent news I've seen on Flanagan South was a March 1st story from the Bartlesville, Oklahoma Examiner Enterprise newspaper, in which they said that construction in their area there in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, on that section of Flanagan South had begun in February. So they broke the construction of this Flanagan South up into either four or five segments. I can't remember which now. And each segment was going to start to the north and move southwest, where it would meet up with another section. And so this section in Oklahoma is really the last section of this thing that needs to be constructed. They expect to finish construction sometime in the fall, and then that would be in service. It's a big pipeline, a 36-inch diameter pipeline with initial capacity of 600,000 barrels per day, but 36-inch diameter is the same size as Keystone XL, so they have the capacity to ramp that up to 800,000, maybe more, barrels per day. And it runs mostly right next to a 60-year-old pipeline called Spearhead, which has a capacity of close to 200,000 barrels per day. So we're talking potentially somewhere near a million barrels per day of tar sands crud, and I do mean crud, going through Missouri and Kansas, because both these pipelines originate in Flanagan, Illinois, which is not too far from Chicago, and they end in Cushing, Oklahoma. Well, if you think about a map, obviously they have to go through Missouri and Kansas to get there, 11 counties in Missouri and 7 counties in Kansas, and passing through the southern reaches of Metro Kansas City. There's no way to stop that pipeline now, I'm afraid. It's a done deal. It didn't need a presidential permit because it doesn't cross a national border.
What about state-to-state thing? Do states just rubber stamp these things, or do they have no say? Or?
Sadly so. The way the regulatory system on pipelines is set up in most states, there's no regulatory authority delegated to the bodies to say no one way or the other. I mean, the one exception is in Minnesota. Minnesota has a body called the Public Utilities Commission, and it's the only one I know of, at least in the Midwest, that actually has the authority to say yes or no to a new pipeline or to a pipeline expansion. And that's really relevant in the context of Flanagan South, because the reason this Enbridge Corporation wants to build Flanagan South is because they also want to expand a pipeline that brings tar sands diluted bitumen in from Canada to Superior, Wisconsin. Because the Flanagan South pipeline by itself is useless. I mean, northern Illinois is not an oil-producing region. Mm. So it has to be connected to pipelines in the north, and that's the case. The big one that we're fighting over, which as the Keystone XL comes to its end, this other one will be ramping up, is over a pipeline called Alberta Clipper, which is an Enbridge pipeline. That pipeline already exists. It went into service in 2010, and it's already has a capacity of 450,000 barrels per day, and it's bringing tar sands, diluted bitumen, into the United States. But Enbridge wants to bring a whole lot more into the United States, so they have implied to Minnesota's government, the Public Utilities Commission, and to the State Department, because Alberta Clipper crosses the national border, for this expansion. They want to take it up to the design capacity of 880,000 barrels per day, currently, again, 450,000 barrels per day. So nearly a doubling of capacity, although on average it would run more like 800,000 barrels per day over the course of a year. We plan to put up a huge fight over that because it shouldn't be expanded, because that will enable increased tar sands production, too. So right now, the process in Minnesota is they're having what's called a contested case hearing, where those who are opposed to the expansion of Alberta Clipper are challenging the initial approval by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to allow the expansion of the Alberta Clipper pipeline. There's going to be a big rally in St. Paul, Minnesota on April 3rd over that. There's a Great
Lakes.
That's
next week. Yeah,
it is, isn't it? Time is flying.
Yeah,
there's the Great Lakes Midwest Tar Sands Coalition is putting on a big rally in conjunction with a public hearing before the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission there. And then there will be the opportunity later, you know, that this expansion will have to go through the same process of a draft supplemental environmental impact statement and a comment period and then a final supplemental impact statement and then another comment period before the State Department rules whether or not the expansion of Alberta Clipper is in the national interest. So we'll... I can't say I'm excited about going through this process again, but so it goes. If they keep giving us things to fight, we'll keep fighting.
Yeah, well, you keep you busy, that's for sure.
Yeah. So that pipeline, again, brings it in from Hardisty in Alberta, Canada, to Superior, Wisconsin, where it feeds into another pipeline that runs from Superior, Wisconsin, to Flanagan, Illinois. And it can also feed into other pipelines that go off to the northeast, too, which... there's more that we're going to have time to get into tonight. But from Flanagan, Illinois, it would go into the Flanagan South Pipeline and the Spearhead Pipeline, where it would go to Cushing, Oklahoma. And from there, it would run through a couple of pipelines that run right next to each other called Seaway that would take it down to Houston, Texas. They're taking what's coming through Spearhead already down to Houston, where it's refined and, again, can be sold on the world market. That's the whole deal here, is let's get this stuff to the world market, because that's the only place to sell it to justify increasing production, I mean tripling production from current levels, more than tripling production from current levels. And long term, they'd like to get up to 9 million barrels per day, maybe more.
I have some questions about...
Sure.
I hear conflicting reports about... whether this will help reduce our dependence on overseas
right.
Energy, or whether we'll start with that.
Yeah.
So I mean, I hear some people saying this is all going to China,
mm-hmm.
and it's not going to do anything for the U.S. energy thirst.
It's not fair, I don't think, to say it's all going to China, but it is about selling it on the world market, because the U.S. doesn't need a lot more of this bitumen to make synthetic crude oil. It's not oil. It's really, really important that people understand that. What's in the tar sands is not oil. We should never call it oil. The industry, in their public statements, will call it oil, but internally, they know it's not oil because they have to actually deal with it. It doesn't behave like oil when it spills. It sinks because it has the consistency of peanut butter until you dilute it. And when it spills in the water, the diluent is what they call it, evaporates. What's left has the consistency of peanut butter. Peanut butter don't float. It sinks. So it's a much bigger problem to clean up when it spills than oil is. So we don't need a lot more of that stuff. It's particularly good, from what I understand, for making what are called distillates, like diesel. We don't have a rapidly increasing demand for diesel fuel. But industrializing countries like China and India and these other places around the world do. So it's really about meeting global demand for more oil, because U.S. demand for oil has actually declined in recent years, and U.S. production of oil has increased. So, you know, some of it would be used in the U.S., but it's not by any means going to make America energy independent. That's or really dramatically reduce imports from other parts of the world. Obviously, there are still imports, so they're coming from Canada.
The other big thing I hear for why this is a good idea is jobs.
Yeah.
And maybe you could...
Yeah, certainly there's a short-term bump in employment to construct this thing, and they're well-paying jobs. I can certainly understand why the pipeline unions want this work, because they're looking at putting food on the tables and for their families and paying their bills, their mortgage, and all of that. I understand why they want the jobs, but it's short-term thinking if we just do this, because the long-term jobs, I can't remember now what the figures are, but the long-term jobs for maintaining these pipelines are tiny. It's a tiny number of jobs, so it's not going to be a significant increase in employment over time. The fact of the matter is as a pipeline is being built, it is an economic boom along the route where it's being built. But, you know, it doesn't take that long to build a pipeline. It's over, and then you're done. Like this Flanagan South pipeline, they started building it in August of last year, and they expect to be finished in autumn of this year. And that's finished with the entire length of it. Sections of it will have been finished long before then, and the boom will be over for those sections. So it's not an economic a jobs plan by any stretch of the imagination, not sensible. We need to be, I'm concerned about people who don't have enough work, don't have enough good paying jobs and that sort of thing. But we need to be putting people to work in the kinds of jobs that build for the future, not the old way of doing things.
Okay, well, I'm going to give out the phone number one more time in case anyone's interested in joining in on the conversation about pipelines, 816-931-5534. But, John, as I look up at the clock and see time slipping away, what haven't we covered that you think is important our listeners to know?
Yeah, just a recent development is Enbridge, again, that's the company that's building Flanagan South across Missouri and Kansas, the company that wants to expand, nearly double the capacity of the Alberta Clipper pipeline, has come up with a really ingenious way to try to evade oversight of their tar sands pipeline plans. They have a pipeline called Line 3, which runs from Alberta, Canada, to Superior, Wisconsin right now. It's an old pipeline, was built in 1968, and it had some flaws in the original construction, so it's a leaky pipeline. The original capacity of Line 3 was 760,000 barrels per day, but they've been running it at a much lower volume, about 390,000-400,000 barrels per day, to reduce stress on the pipeline and to make leaks, spills less likely. Well, they announced just a few weeks ago that they were going to, in their terms, replace Line 3. Well, what replacing Line 3 actually means is that they're going to build an entirely new pipeline next to it, which is bigger in diameter. The original Line 3 is 34-inch. This is going to be a 36-inch pipeline with all the latest technology. And then once it's replaced, they're going to go from shipping light sweet crude oil through it, which is what's been shipped ever since, to shipping a mixture of light sweet crude and this heavy dilbit, diluted bitumen from the tar sands, with the emphasis on the dilbit because that's where the capacity, the production increases are expected to come. Over time, the production of light sweet crude oil in Canada is going to decline, even though there's been a temporary bump from fracking there. Now, where they're getting really tricky is what they've announced is that they're only going to replace sections that run as far as Gretna in Manitoba, Canada, and from Neche, North Dakota, south. Well, if you think about that, that skips the part that actually crosses the border. And they claim, because they don't intend to replace that, that they don't have to get an amendment for their presidential permit from the State Department. And therefore, they can avoid all of the scrutiny that comes with getting a new or amended presidential permit. Now, you just know that they intend to come back after they've replaced the rest of the thing and say, oh, we realize that, gosh darn it, if this thing's going to be safe, we got to replace that section that crosses the border, too. And what's the State Department going to say at that point? Is the State Department going to deny them an amendment to their permit to do that? No. These guys are getting really tricky.
Sounds like it. Well, we've apparently struck a nerve. We've got several callers in the pipeline, if you'll forgive the use of that word. First caller, you're on the air. What's your name and what part of town you calling from? Hello? Caller, you're on the air. All right. Maybe we lost that one. Let's try this one. Caller, you're on the air. What's your name and what part of town are you calling from?
Hi, living in Lawrence, Kansas. This is Clint White.
Hi. What's your question or comment?
Well, I work with piping of some chemicals in a water production plant, and I know that piping lime produces a lot of wear on the infrastructure and can cause the parts to wear out, and preventive maintenance, you know, hopefully catches that, but if it doesn't, it gets everywhere. So I was wondering if the tar sands have a lot of sand in them and how much pumping needs to be done to get that here, how you pump peanut butter has to be heated along the way.
Right.
That's like a five-part question, I think.
Yeah, that's a really great question, Clint. It has the consistency of peanut butter, bitumen has the consistency of peanut butter in its raw form. Now, if we take a step before that, the tar sands themselves are a mixture of sand, clay, silt, and bitumen, and water, 85% sand, clay, and silt, 10% bitumen, and then the rest is water. Now, the stuff that they would be pumping through Keystone XL and the stuff they're already pumping through the Alberta Clipper is extracted from deep deposits using a method that leave most of the sand, clay, and silt behind because they don't want that stuff. That would just be a waste disposal problem if they got that out. So it leaves most of it behind, but it doesn't leave all of it behind. So what they're shipping through the pipelines does contain some of that, and it does cause more friction, raises the temperature of the pipeline, puts more stress on the pipeline. This stuff is more corrosive than light sweet crude oil is. And then, of course, they have to dilute it. When they pump it through a pipeline, they use a diluting agent or a diluent, and it runs about 30% of the diluting agent to 70% of the bitumen. Again, that stuff, the diluting agents, just evaporate if it spills, and then you're left with the peanut butter consistency. But that's how they get it to flow through a pipeline. It is it does put more wear on a pipeline than light sweet crude oil, which is a concern even with these brand new pipelines when they're built, but particularly because they've repurposed a lot of old pipelines to ship this stuff that were never intended for this, like that Spearhead pipeline I was talking about that runs from Flanagan, Illinois to Cushing, Oklahoma.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Clint. We're going to let you go because we're going to want to try and squeeze in one more caller. Caller, you're on the air. What's your name and what part of town are you calling from?
I'm Diana, and I'm from Lawrence. And although the pipeline has come through Lawrence or it has been built, is the bus leaving from Wichita going to stop in Lawrence, and are there going to be any public demonstrations, so to speak, in Lawrence in that time frame after Earth Day?
There is, as part of that No Keystone XL Pledge of Resistance I talked about, there is going to be, if the State Department rules it's in the national interest, there will be peaceful civil disobedience in Topeka. That's the nearest I know of to Lawrence for an action in Kansas. I would certainly expect that the bus heading east for the April 27th Reject and Protect rally will stop in Lawrence along the way, just as it's going to stop in the Kansas City area. Again, if you want information about that, all the details are not yet pinned down. Send an email to 350kclead, L-E-A-D, @gmail.com.
Okay, and I did have another question, but maybe you don't have time for it.
Quickly.
Okay, I believe I saw a gentleman on Bill Moyer's journal who first perhaps might have started this 350.com.
Yeah,
am
Bill
I
McKibben.
Right about that?
It was probably Bill McKibben. Yes, he's been on Bill Moyer's journal.
And what is his name?
Bill McKibben.
He had worked in the State Department or Environmental Protection Agency or something?
No, that wouldn't be Bill McKibben.
Okay.
You must be referring to someone else.
Well, no, it could have been this man, and I was very interested in that. So it's great to hear all this is going on.
Yeah, Bill McKibben was one of the co-founders
okay.
of 350.org.
Right. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for your call. That's about all the time we're going to have, John. Thank you so much for quite a lot of information you got in there. And,
I posted a couple links to Eco Radio KC's Facebook page with additional info.
Good. That's great. All right. Well, thanks again. And now we're going to turn it over to Natural E for the calendar.
Hello, everyone. There's a few events going on March 27th from 9 in the morning until noon. There's Westport Tree Planting with the Heartland Tree Alliance. The Heartland Tree Alliance seeks volunteers to help plant 21 trees in the historic Westport District. It's funded by the Harley-Davidson Foundation, and this project seeks to replant areas where trees die due to disease or vandalism. All the tools will be provided, and the volunteers are asked to wear sturdy shoes, long pants, and brain gloves, and you must register in advance, and I've posted a link to be able to do that on our Facebook page. Coming up this Saturday, on March 29th, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Johnson County Community College, is the 14th annual Kansas City Eat Local and Organic Food Expo. So there's one this Saturday, and then one at Penn Valley is on Saturday, April 12th, from 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. There will be local growers of organic and free-range produce selling their wares, including garden plant starts, as well as free organic gardening information and free 2014 producers directory. And then finally, the Healthy Yards Expo on March 29th from 9 a.m. to noon. It's the fifth annual Johnson County Healthy Yards Expo. It's a lawn and garden event that aims to help citizens make greener choices in their yards and homes. The expo focuses on Kansas Healthy Yards and Communities. KHYC is a program developed by Kansas State University Research and Extension. KHYC helps homeowners make wise choices on environmentally conscious lawn and garden care techniques. And this takes place in Overland Park at 138th and Johnson Drive. Okay, so that's Shawnee, Kansas. And it's from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. on March 29th, and these events can be found on greenability.com.
Thank you very much, Natural E. And if you haven't gotten enough environmental info for the evening, I would remind folks that on the other side of Missouri, at the community radio station in St. Louis, KDHX, their environmental program, Earthworms, is starting up at 7 p.m. with Gene Ponzi. But, of course, you can always keep it right here at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, for Sabor Latino. We're going to go out with a song by David Rovix called Pipeline.
As soon as they started drilling for oil, they started building pipelines on the seabed, through the forests, and across the border lines. As soon as they started laying the pipe, they said, "We'll do this safely. There will never be an accident. We can do this carefully." But the sands shift, the ice melts, disasters are routine. Point out their record of destruction, and they'll say their hands are clean. Point out their woeful deeds, and they'll consult their banker and say it's safer to use a pipeline than an oil tanker. So now they want to see how far their madness it can go. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. The tar sands line the north beneath Alberta's ground. As the price of oil rises, the oil men have found. Now there's profit to be made in a madman's dream by drilling deep beneath earth, blasting it with steam, bulldozing the land, melting what's inside, a record of extinction 1,000 miles wide. But laying waste to the northern plains is evidently not enough. The capitalists need markets where they can sell this toxic stuff. So across the farms and prairies, the oil now must flow. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. Governors oppose it. Every native band, ranchers don't want it passing through their land. Union leaders have denounced it, as have the rank and file. The president delayed it for just a little while. They say you can't stop progress. I hope that isn't true, cause if we mine the tar sands, if we let the pipeline through, it will be a pipeline to oblivion, a pipeline to the end, a pipeline to a future with nothing round the bend. A pipeline to a future that I hope we'll never know. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. Pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico.
On March 29th, Saturday, the outreach team will host a Veterans Benefit Fair and Resource Expo at the Kansas City VA Medical Center, 4801 Linwood. The event will be held from 9 a.m. to noon. Approximately 30 local organizations, federal agencies, and VA entities have confirmed their participation and will be sharing information on veteran benefits and community resources. Again, that's Saturday, March 29th at the VA Medical Center. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Están escuchando KKFI, 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Radio de la Comunidad.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.